Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Tim Oppler, Paul Matisse, Luba Greenwood, and Peter Kolchinski. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So after a very volatile year, which was looking like the third year in a row with XBI down double digits, the last few months brought some relief and optimism for biotech, and the XBI actually closed green on the year. This was driven by strong M&A. In fact, 2023 was a record M&A year, both in terms of dollar amounts and number of deals. And the year end brought some really nice momentum with three big M&A transactions. Josh and Paul, let's start with the BMS Karuna deal, which was the second largest deal this year after Pfizer Seagen.
Great. I can chime in briefly since I do a lot of neuro, and then Josh would love your perspective on this one or the others too. So Bristol Myers Squibb agreed to acquire Karuna for around $14 billion for their lead drug KarXT. I should probably be saying congratulations to you, Daphne, since your involvement in the creation of Karuna. And it's a really big deal for a few reasons. You know, one, it validates the blockbuster potential and the paradigm shift associated with KarXT and other muscarinics in schizophrenia. Two, in the investor community, there's been this kind of overarching question as to whether we'll see real M&A in the neuropsychiatry space. And the first wave of companies that kind of became independent neuropsych companies, like, you know, Alkermes, Intracellular, Neurocrine Acadia, it never happened. And now we've seen it for Karuna and Cerevel. You know, and then I think, you know, the third point is just, it's interesting on the timing of Karuna since it happens just weeks after Cerevel gets acquired. And, you know, when Cerevel was acquired, there was a perceived question on whether that was sort of chosen over Karuna because of the composition of matter intellectual property associated with emraclidine. Clearly that was not the right read. So, you know, fascinating deal all around and great for the space.
Yeah, Bristol's been throwing around some big bucks in the final months of the year with Mirati, Karuna, Raise. Of those three, at least in terms of the valuation and getting what they paid for it, I thought Raise seemed to make a lot of sense. That's a very powerful, differentiated radiopharmaceutical platform. Certainly argue about some of the other prices that Bristol's been paying for these companies, a number of whom, you know, have or are facing competitive threats. You know, Turning Point is an example. The KRAS space is pretty intense around Mirati. Obviously, some intense competition in the schizophrenia space for some of the muscarinic programs. So it does, though, harken back to, I think we're talking like over a decade ago, the Bristol Myers String of Pearls strategy to try to put together, you know, a pipeline to deliver longer term growth. So it's something that they certainly need to be doing. And we'll, you know, probably take a number of years to figure out if those turn out to be NPV positive type transactions. One of the other deals that was announced towards the end of last year was the AstraZeneca acquisition of Gracell, and the press release really emphasized the potential of CAR T therapeutics in immunology, which is something that we've spoken about on a number of occasions on the Hangout platform. So that was a notable deal as well. And for a company that isn't really viewed as being in the lead at least in immunology CAR-T platforms, now they do have a myeloma program that is further advanced than their immunology effort. But very interesting to see Astra jumping into the fray as well. And it still leaves quite a number of large pharma companies in the immunology space that do not have leading programs with cell therapy. So we might see continued partnerships in the months and or years ahead.
Josh, what's your view on the safety profile going from oncology to immunology? There's this theory that in immunology, there's potentially less antigenic burden and safety is going to be cleaner and enable it to not just be a niche approach. Have you guys done work there?
Yeah, I've done tons of work on this general space. No doubt that what we're seeing thus far in the immunology setting, much better tolerated, not too different than what you might see actually in maybe like follicular or more indolent lymphomas, where actually the CAR T profile is far more gentle. You know, it's where you really have that big tumor bulk that you can wind up with trouble with cytokine release syndrome. I've been doing a lot of work on this recent signal of peripheral T cell lymphoma that emerged in the CAR T programs for lymphoma and myeloma. Personally, I think that's going to prove to be a red herring when it comes to immunology. But you know, it's a good time to mention Iovance. They got put on clinical hold for their non-small cell lung cancer TIL program, attributed to an unfortunate fatality event that may have been related to the lymphodepletion condition. So, you know, the reality is that fludarabine and cyclophosphamide in the doses that are used in CAR T, you know, is not benign. Like there are side effects that can be immunosuppressive and can cause some other morbidity, hopefully, you know, very, very, very rare mortality events, but that's something that we'll all have to keep an eye on. But thus far, in I think we're close to like 24 patients with immunology conditions treated with CAR T. You know, just a little bit of cytokine release syndrome seems to be fairly manageable. Some expected neutropenias, but otherwise benign. And you know, hopefully that'll continue. But also have to be cognizant of the fact that there may be some more significant side effects, and so you have to overlay that on top of the unmet medical need. You know, some of those patients are, as you all know, are very, very sick and have limited treatment options. And so, you know, if there is a risk of more severe events, it can still play an important role just because the unmet need is so high.
Interesting.
Tim, do you have any thoughts on the deals that close at the end of the year?
I think it was a strong year. I think some of the transactions were pretty interesting. So like Josh, I would highlight the Raise transaction. What's interesting there is you saw Bristol entering radiopharmaceuticals. That's an important step for that sector. They entered into a point of vulnerability for Novartis, which is in alpha particles, which have higher efficacy, but also higher risk. And their lead drug, which is an actinium-based competitor to Novartis's Lutathera, looks really strong. So I think this is going to be a big year for radiopharma. And in general, I expect this year to be also very robust for M&A. So the trend we saw in December should continue over. I have noticed on Twitter, you know, speculation like how many deals are we going to have before JP Morgan or the day of JP Morgan. I mean, I have no insight into that whatsoever. At some level, it doesn't matter. But for the year, it should be very robust.
If you look historically, at least in terms of dollar value of deal, you tend to congregate in fourth quarter and first quarter. You know, a very strong finish to the year in December, which I suspect may have something to do with some of the accounting changes that went into effect in 2022 around IPR&D, where companies are really no longer allowed to strip out these transactions and the pro forma estimates. And so the best time to do it then is in December, when no one really cares about the year anymore, and everyone's starting to look forward to the year ahead. So it'll be interesting to see if we get, you know, a mini wave around January this year, or whether many of those transactions just got shifted into December as a result of that. Daphne, I'm curious to hear your reaction to the Karuna transaction, having been the pioneering force behind that asset.
Yeah, thank you. It was a nice way to end the year. You know, one of the great things about Karuna is it was one of those rare cases where everyone involved did well. And, you know, CNS is really exciting because of the huge needs and blockbuster potential, but it has one of the worst clinical success translation rates. So, you know, there are some really interesting drugs that have shown clinical efficacy, but had some issue that held back development. And xanomeline was one of those drugs that showed remarkable efficacy, but it was sitting on a shelf at Eli Lilly due to GI tolerability issues. So a couple of members of our team came up with the idea of the agonist-antagonist concept, which reduced the GI AEs by about 50%. And then starting with an active drug, the success rate was really remarkable. Karuna had 100% success rate, basically read out three unequivocally positive registration-enabling studies, and I think helped reinvigorate the interest in the muscarinic receptor modulation area, as we saw with the $8.7 billion transaction between AbbVie and Cerevel. So, I'm actually really excited about CNS, and I think that there's a lot we can do by starting with drugs that already have efficacy but have some flaws. So that's an area I'm personally excited about. And then, like more broadly thinking about CNS, there was some other news related to that. So we have both Longboard, which I think was really interesting. They had a great clinical readout, which caused the share price to triple on the news, and then they did an upsized $210 million offering. Actually, curious, Paul, what do you think of the data at Longboard?
Well, Josh covers it, and I think maybe the axe on the stock. So I'll be really brief, and then I want to hear his perspective.
No, Paul, I actually can't comment on Longboard.
Oh, is that right? Okay, all right, that's fine. Okay, well, I'm commenting on this not from a stock perspective, but just through the lens of covering GW and Zogenix and Xenon and seeing some early stage epilepsy trials. And I think, look, the data from a clinical perspective look really promising. I think we've seen on motor seizures specifically that even in small sample sizes, the effect size tends to hold up from an early trial. So as much as that is an early trial, if you look at like the early Epidiolex data and Dravet syndrome, they're reporting around a 50% seizure reduction that regressed to 40% in phase three. So that's not bad. Unlike other areas of CNS, Daphne, as you were alluding to, epilepsy, if you look at the right seizure endpoint, is pretty good. Those indications like Dravet, LGS, DE have a lot of unmet need. And this drug has some commonalities with the Zogenix compound Fintepla that UCB owns, right? But that compound has the cardiac liabilities. And even though in these severe diseases, I think patients are willing to tolerate the risk, it makes that drug a lot more cumbersome to use. You need to have, in Dravet, a pediatric cardiologist. So I think, again, I don't have a view on the stock or the revenue potential of the drug, but just from a purely clinical perspective, the signal looks promising, and I think there's real precedent in epilepsy where you just don't have big placebo effect in these indications. And I know they had a placebo arm too, but just even in terms of, excuse me, the replicability of it looks strong.
What'd you think about the Voyager Novartis collaboration expansion?
That's also pretty interesting as well, right? I mean, I think, and maybe Josh, you can opine on this too, because I know you do a lot in gene therapy. It feels kind of like in the life cycle of gene therapy, right? We had this period of extreme exuberance, a number of setbacks and almost a complete flip in sentiment. And now some level of kind of equilibrium, right? Where you've got a number of next gen companies with different platforms that kind of leverage the learnings, of some of the initial setbacks and either widen the therapeutic index or increase precision or improve biodistribution. And that looks like what Voyager potentially has here. I know their technology some from just Neurocrine doing a collaboration with them and being really, really bullish on how differentiated what they're doing is from other CNS technologies. And not to go down a rabbit hole, but there's just a number of other gene therapy companies too, right? Where the way that they're trying to deliver transgenes in a more regulated fashion or a more precise fashion has greatly improved. And so, the diseases that are named in this collaboration are no piece of cake, right? I mean, Huntington's, there's a lot of question around, mutant Huntington knockdown in the right areas of the brain, the safety around wild type, and SMA, right? I mean, there's good treatments for SMA, but just kind of further validation that the technology in this space is greatly improving, and it's another, validating deal for Voyager.
Yeah, I would just add on the CNS side of gene therapy. There was so much excitement after Zolgensma's really transformational data in spinal muscular atrophy. But subsequent to that, I think everyone learned how difficult delivery is to the CNS. Whether it's intrathecal or others, and whereas gene therapy has had success in certain organ settings, liver, heart, arguably muscle. Eye and brain have been quite elusive. So it looks like Voyager thinks they've got a capsid profile that perhaps can be administered systemically and cross into the brain. That is a tall ask. So we'll kind of have to see if that that proves successful. But then also there are other really interesting technologies, like I'd flag Denali, that has a platform that can cross the blood-brain barrier with larger molecules. JCR Pharma is another company doing that. You know, so delivery to the brain remains very elusive for gene therapy. So we'll just have to give it time and see if Voyager and Novartis can crack it, or if others can. And 4D and Arbor also announced a collaboration using 4D's CNS targeting capsids with Arbor's CRISPR platform. I think they're starting with ALS, and so just one thing to keep in mind when we talk about CNS or neuro diseases, that there is a big difference between targeting the brain and the cortex for certain diseases, such as, you know, perhaps Huntington's, versus targeting the spinal cord with for ALS and other approaches.
Paul, you are going to cover the FDA approval of the AstraZeneca Ionis ATTRPN drug and its potential in other indications. And then after that, can you go to Dyne Therapeutics, positive initial POC?
Yeah, happy to. So the FDA approved the AstraZeneca Ionis drug, eplontersen, for the treatment of TTR polyneuropathy. The approval was widely expected because the data were great, but it's a big milestone for Ionis, in large part because it's an approval using their LICA technology. You know, antisense oligonucleotide drugs originally were limited by their TI, not great biodistribution, and a number of immunogenic-related adverse events. And so this technology allows them to lower the dose something like 20x over the first-gen drug, Tegsedi, which hasn't gotten a ton of commercial traction. So this is a big deal in them kind of narrowing the competitive gap in this space. And, you know, if you look at the label, it looks very, very clean. The big event that the street is watching in TTR this year is the Alnylam Helios B trial, which will be the big test of the silencer mechanism in TTR cardiomyopathy. We know that the silencers, or I guess we don't know, but it seems pretty reasonable to say that the silencers look like they're most efficacious relative to stabilizers in polyneuropathy. And the question is that going to translate into cardiomyopathy? And there's other complicated nuances around that trial as well, but there's big read-through to Ionis, who's a fast follower there. And then maybe just switching gears to Dyne, who had initial data, you know, kind of like what Josh was saying with Denali and JCR, for a transferrin conjugate platform, using that same target to increase biodistribution in muscle. The main focus of those data, they had data in DMD and myotonic dystrophy, but the main focus was myotonic dystrophy, where they saw dose-dependent changes in muscle exposure, DMPK knockdown, and splicing. It's early data, and they showed some early clinical data for the low dose, which looked promising. Some of the kind of controversy around these data, and, you know, they did have a nice stock reaction, but some of the controversy around these data centered around, you know, some of the variability in the biomarker measures, specifically at the low dose. But it's small patient samples, and it does seem like in a broad strokes kind of way that they've proven out that their technology works. You know, DM1 is one of those orphan markets that's really big, and one of the few too that is really white space as well. So they're going to have additional data from some higher doses and longer term follow up later this year. The other companies to watch in this space include Avidity, who had some data, and then PepGen and Trotta, and Ionis has been working on some stuff here as well.
Great. So we'll move to a couple of finance-related news items, and then we're going to transition to some big-picture topics and discussion, and hopefully a little bit of debate as well. So, Luba, I've actually been interested to see more royalty and project financing deals. Can you take us through the Immunity Bio Oberland deal?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually great news for these types of deals, and actually really good news for immunotherapy and cell therapy platforms and cancer overall. As you know, especially immunotherapy has not been the most exciting area. So this is further excitement for that space. As you remember, back in October, Immunity Bio, they submitted a BLA. They are expecting approval of their IL-15 drug, Anktiva, which is a drug for treatment of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. The financing was led by Oberland Capital. And again, it allows Immunity Bio to not just commercialize their drug, but also go beyond bladder cancer into other solid tumor indications. The deal is overall $320 million. Initially, at closing in December, they received $210 million, and they're going to be the remaining of $100 million to be paid at approval. They also received a small equity investment of $10 million with a purchase, an option to purchase additional $10 million. Later on. And in terms of the royalty, what's interesting, it is a great example of a strong royalty deal. Oberland Capital will get a piece of their future profits. They're starting with a smaller royalty rate of 3-7% on net sales of the drug. Now that's worldwide, excluding China. Of course, that's going to be capped at a multiple of what Oberlin has invested. So they decided on about 195% return with the opportunity to increase and go beyond potentially into double-digit royalty payments later on as well. And why is that a good news for Immunity Bio? They really needed a deal. And I think this is the type of deal that other companies that have faced challenges should look into. They, as you may remember, they had a major setback last year when the FDA rejected their drug. They had tons of layoffs. Their stock lost half of its value. They had literally a little over $40 million in the bank. So this type of a royalty deal is a win-win. They get non-dilutive funding, and it puts them on a great path to success and growth, and also allows them to commercialize the drug once it's approved. So wish them luck in actually getting the approval in April. Their stock is a bit down right now, but overall up since the news.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see how some of these royalty players are moving towards earlier, smaller companies. So one of our colleagues, Jing Ling, was talking about Opthea, which is a $200 million market cap Australian biotech that just raised $85 million in non-dilutive development funding from Carlyle and Abingworth. And I think part of this is also driven by some recent accounting changes that make it harder for big pharma to do these types of deals. So it's definitely interesting to see this source of capital be available to smaller companies. What are your thoughts about the new Goldman Sachs Life Science Fund?
Yeah, that's great. I love it. You know, we've actually been hearing about Goldman Sachs having their own life sciences investment fund for a few years now. So it's great to see them actually raising the $650 million first ever fund. It's called West Street Life Sciences. What I like is that they'll be investing in early to mid stage. Sometimes funds like this go after a later stage. So it's great that they're interested in early stage companies, and they have invested in those as well. They are going to be investing in focusing on precision medicine, cell therapies, immunotherapies, like everybody else, AI-enabled therapeutics. But what's interesting is they're also looking into life science tools and diagnostics. I do wonder what's the percentage of their potential portfolio that they would like to dedicate to those companies, but it's great to see that they are open to investments in that space. The fund also, it's managed by a great team. And actually, they have already done some investments before. It's managed by the Life Sciences Investing Group at Goldman Sachs Asset Management, which is led by Amit Sinha, who started that fund in 2021. And if you look closely at the group and what they've done, they did tend to focus overall on oncology, neuro, and rare disease. We expect them to do the same and continue to do the same. And they have already invested in five companies and deployed $90 million. So it's good to see some traction. I also like that this group has actually disclosed their raise, and they've already made strong bets on companies, which is, I have to say, a bit different than JP Morgan, which, you know, raised a fund in November 2022. And they have really yet to formulate a full plan or strategy for investment or disclose the amount that they have raised and deployed so far. So already Goldman Sachs here is coming out, is a serious team, experienced team that can lead. So a great addition to the mix. The only other thing I would add, it is great to see a first time fundraising this year. Because we really have had the lowest fundraising year last year since 2013. We've only raised, first-time funds only raised $11.6 billion as opposed to $25.6 billion, so more than double in 2022. So you can see they definitely recognize potential to take advantage of low valuations and really lack of bold new early stage investors in the market right now. So opportunity, yeah, lots of opportunities here to lead, set their own terms, which we are seeing many first-time funds do as well, and picking modalities and therapeutic areas that are ripe for growth. So good to see them.
Great. Okay, well, let's shift gears and move to some sort of big questions and thoughts around the industry. Peter, tell us about the report you just put out.
Sure. So we started crunching a ton of data back a couple of years ago on just the sector dynamics, how companies are getting funded, which companies are getting acquired, just sort of trying to figure out how do we look at the whole sector top down. And it's pretty difficult to do on the private side, though we do have our ways of tracking that. But it was a lot of fun, actually, to crunch a ton of data on the public side. We mixed and matched 13Fs and financial statements. And as we started asking questions, we found that the data yielded up some interesting insights. And so we kicked off this series we call Semper Maior, which it stands for always better, which is a nice attitude to go into biotech with. You know, for all of our failings, we aspire to be better. And so this is the, you know, I think the third in the series now. And it really taught us about the importance of having specialist backing. We'd certainly like to believe that we specialists are relevant and important, but wow, you know, this was a year of very disparate returns. Those companies that had no peer specialist holders at the start of 2023 really, on average, had a pretty bad year. You know, as we looked into other parameters, we looked at, you know, the years of cash that a company had, for example. We had thought that one might define a so-called like danger zone for a company as having less than 2 years of cash, because odds are you'll end up financing in the coming year, and having a pretty high burn rate relative to your market cap, right? And so what we found after a year of tracking these companies is that actually those companies that had less than 2 years of cash did fine. Like, and surprisingly high burn rates did fine. Companies in the danger zone did fine unless they had less than a year of cash. And, you know, that's a much smaller set of companies. And we know that most companies try to raise money before they get down to a year of cash. And so what we saw was the effects, we believe, of adverse selection. When a company tries to raise and can't, that's a problem. But just simply being down to, you know, 2 years of cash or 1.5 years of cash or whatever, that didn't seem to be that much of a problem in a pretty difficult year. So, you know, that really gets you thinking about, is the notion of a financing overhang, is that real? You know, and it may not really be real until you get to levels of cash that suggested that you probably tried to raise and couldn't, right? So there's other insights that came from the report. It's about 50 pages long, and we had a team of about six people crunching data pretty late at night. To get this thing out, and it's fun. And then we use it as a vehicle also to share some other insights about kind of where we hope this industry will go, not just in terms of funding companies and all that, but to take a step back and to think bigger about the need to protect innovation, for example. And we've got a whole section in there about the importance of people getting off the sidelines and really playing an active role in defending the biotech social contract, as we call it, and fighting for affordable innovation and getting involved with No Patient Left Behind.
So let's come back to some of the ways that people can get involved in some of these bigger overhang issues for the industry. But I'd like to come back to this idea of the core companies. These are the companies that are backed by specialists versus the ones that aren't. And you make a case there that the specialist backed core companies outperform. And you know, you just made a point about not being able to raise capital. So wouldn't it be, part of that would be that if you already have a bunch of specialists in a company, they're more likely to finance when you need the money. You know, would that be one of the reasons for those companies being less in a danger zone?
Well, what's fun about these analyses, right, is that, yeah, we can hypothesize. There's all kinds of logic. But specialists aren't the only ones who fund companies, right? I mean, you just take a look at the allocations in an IPO. There's lots of funds in there that we would consider to be specialist peers, right? They may think of themselves as specialists. To be clear, we've got our own subjective list that happens to include ourselves and 40 other funds, right? So this is really just our judgment of, you know, who are the specialists. So it's not a given that these companies that didn't happen to have any of these particular 41 funds showing up as shareholders would not be able to raise or would not perform. But, you know, it's a reasonable hypothesis. You know, I would imagine if all 41 funds aren't interested in holding your stock, you know, then it might be a bit more challenging to raise. What's also interesting is, you know, looking at M&A dollars, like where do the dollars flow? You know, we had all these companies get acquired. We calculated there was about $35 billion of M&A premium that flowed into, you know, this pool of companies, these development stage biotech companies under $10 billion. And it turns out that over 99% of those dollars flowed to companies that had at least one specialist holder, virtually nothing. Half a billion flowed to, you know, the set of companies that didn't have any specialist holders. And look, the majority of the sector is made up of on a weighted basis. And this is another key point of the report, that we shouldn't just be counting the hundreds of companies out there. We should be weighting them, you know, for their market caps or even liquidity. And what you'll see is the majority of the sector is really represented by the, what was it, like about 55% of companies that are core, right? So as you weight the sector, you see that probably the better companies have managed to attract at least one specialist, and it's those better companies that are more likely to get acquired. These are all reasonable hypotheses, and the data support it.
Yeah, you know, I've been wondering a lot about this concept of how do generalists, you know, so biotech does well when generalists come in, and they're a crucial player in sort of what I think you were calling it, the conveyor belt. But you know, isn't this making a case to generalists in on some levels? I guess one case you're making is that they should invest in deals that have some specialists in them, some of the 40 or so that you're that were in your group. But you know, aren't there a lot of things that happen that sort of stack the decks against generalists? Like, for example, you know, the wall-crossed pipes that are, you know, usually offered to the specialists where they get information ahead of others. And, you know, what do you think in general about how friendly are we as an industry to the generalists that we need? And like, what's a way for a generalist to make money if the, you know, if they're kind of disadvantaged to begin with?
So I have absolutely zero sympathy for generalists, and I'm not here to help them make money. I'm going to compete fiercely, and we are absolutely going to do everything we can, you know, to have companies select us as a preferred shareholder, and we'll bend over backwards to, you know, try to win the case that we are, you know, a better fund to allocate to than some other fund. And I think every other specialist out there probably feels similarly, right? So financings, like, that's not the only way to get exposure to a company. Generalists are perfectly welcome to go out there and buy stock on the open market. We do that too. It's not like we only build our portfolio through financings. So I suppose maybe what the data suggests is that if there's no evidence whatsoever that a company, you know, is of interest to specialists, and I should caveat that 13F data are not perfect, right? So, you know, it's delayed information. There's some forms of holdings that don't show up on 13Fs. They're only useful for US listed companies. But in any case, if a generalist sees that, you know, there's no specialist holders, yeah, they ought to be careful. You know, there's probably a reason for that. If it does have specialist holders, it's certainly no guarantee either. You know, we did some really egregious data dredging in this data set. So we did have some fun with it. And truly nobody needs to go into this report saying, well, that, you know, you didn't prospectively define that. You're right. These data analyses were fun. You know, we don't take them too seriously. They're hypothesis generating. We'll see if they hold up. But we saw, for example, that companies that already had, I think it was like 7 specialist holders, you know, did not necessarily do better than companies that had 3 at the start of 2023. Rather, what was more important was that a company increase the number of specialist holders, you know, net specialist holders over the year. So they don't have to be the same specialist holders, but, you know, an increasing number of specialist holders was correlated with improved performance. And if your the number of holders was static, even if it was high, you know, that did not, you know, correlate with outperformance. So we end up defining a set of core companies that we called climbers that had a growing number of specialists. And, you know, there were 92 in that set, and they were the ones that drove all the returns for the set of core companies we called the left behind. The acquisitions certainly drove returns. In fact, if you subtract acquisitions, IBB and XBI were both roughly flat on the year. The core set was still up. Instead of being up about 16%, it was up about 6. But it was those 92 climbers that had an increased number of specialists that further drove, that sort of did all the work for that left behind set. So take out the acquisitions, take out those 92 companies that had an increasing number of specialists over the course of the year, and you actually had pretty blah returns, if not negative.
So I'd love to get some thoughts from Tim on, you know, the analysis that Peter did and RA Capital did, and also some more insights from your latest report, which makes some predictions about 2024 in terms of macro issues, IRA, hot areas, capital markets, et cetera. So Tim, any thoughts on first what Peter was just talking about, and then I would love to hear about your report. And we'll come back, Peter, to some of the IRA related issues and how people can make a difference in a moment. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, so, you know, Peter's emphasized it was like a lot of work. So I've done something relatively similar, I would say probably a bit flimsier than what Peter's team's done. So just to give you a sense, we processed at Stifel over 500,000 company shareholder records. So when you actually pull the data and analyze the data, it's an unbelievable amount of work. Like, who is this shareholder? Is this a specialist? Peter, I think you made it easy by just like, are these people, you know, one of 41 people on the list? We actually went through each shareholder online on LinkedIn to see if they had a PhD on their staff to define whether or not they were a specialist. So I think we did it a little differently. We ended up with about 110 institutional shareholders that had at least one PhD in the sciences, biosciences, to be clear, and define those guys as specialists. When we looked
at
the
data, by the way, if you send me that list, we'll subtract out our 41 from that and do a comparison to find out whether a PhD matters. I'm going to go on the record and say not much.
I mean, there's no comparison between like an RA or a Deerfield and, you know, the fund in the Midwest, it's got one PhD, right? It's not the same, but that's how we did it, just kind of arbitrarily. And we found very similar things. So indeed, specialists were incredibly important in 2023. If it makes sense, it was a down market. So the sophisticated, committed investor that really understands the company is much more likely to be there. The things that really happened in the market since the downturn to, you know, shareholder base, it's not just generalists left the sector, but retail left the sector. And probably the single most important investor type in our sector, it's not the generalist, it's not retail, it's the index funds. So index funds are incredibly important. And index funds tended to pull out as companies saw their performance drop. So a lot of these index funds have market cap sort of thresholds for getting included in, say, the Russell 2000 or what have you. And so that was something that really accentuated the downturn. And, you know, thank God we have such a healthy group of specialist funds in our market. I think in many ways it defines what this market is, and the fact that the specialists have, in some sense, an edge in understanding these companies is very helpful. Daphne, your question's an important one, which is, well, we need those generalists. like, how do we make sure the market isn't disadvantaged? I'll speak as a banker working at Stifel. Hey, if there's a generalist that wants to wall cross on a pipe that we're doing, we are happy to wall cross them. The issue I think that you're really referring to is more retail, right? Retail doesn't get the wall cross. And, you know, how do you make sure the market isn't disadvantaged to retail? And, you know, just to make an obvious point, there are any number of specialist mutual funds that have relatively modest fees that retail can access if they, you know, don't want to go and take the plunge on any individual stock. And I don't think that, you know, like retail is being disadvantaged by, you know, 50 basis points or more because they lack access to pipes. So pipes are a relatively small edge for the specialist fund. The specialist fund edge obviously comes from their ability to analyze and understand, you know, the very broad swath of companies that are found in our ecosystem.
Josh and Paul, I would love to hear from you and Luba as well on the report and this discussion about specialists and generalists and just the market dynamics in general.
Well, just my views on generalist investors, you know, there are always exceptions, but most of them are not comfortable in biotech. Most try to avoid biotech unless they kind of have to. When they come into biotech, they tend to focus on you know, some of the more mature companies with revenue and cash flow. And they tend to be the most fickle of investors because they don't really want to be there if they don't have to. They tend to come in when they feel like the momentum's starting to shift and they have to be there, that FOMO drive. And so, you know, they can be great for lifting stocks and also great for signaling the end of the buy opportunity and just waiting for them to shift back out and valuations to become compelling or attractive again. So, you know, you got to be a little bit careful in terms of what you ask for. That said, you know, there are some very thoughtful generalist investors who do traffic in biotech, but they tend to be few and far between, and understandably so. Like, it's such a nuanced space, and if you compare biotech to almost any other vertical where there's such homogeneity amongst the companies, you know, think about banks, think about oil and gas companies, think about home builders. They all more or less do the same thing. And so there's, you know, it's efficient to cover a broad industry, whereas in biotech, you know, it's so challenging. Companies are so different, very little kind of a synergies of knowledge and learning from looking at one company to another. And so shouldn't be surprising that generalist investors feel very, very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I completely agree with everyone's statements. I would add, though, that in the area, for example, of other life sciences areas like life sciences tools and diagnostics, which relies on a very different financial fundamentals, generalists have been helpful. But I can see, and I do see, that in biotech, it's just because it's such a different, it's not a homogeneous type of an industry, so it's very different. I can see the need to rely on specialists, although I do see that there could be potentially opportunities to educate and support generalists a little more to see if they could be as helpful as they are in the other life sciences industries to biotech.
Great. Peter, Paul, did you want to say anything?
No, I got nothing new because I agree with it all. Thanks.
Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about our expectations for 2024, but I did want to get back to you, Peter, in how to be a better biotech kind of citizen. How do we make sure that we're doing everything we can for the industry? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've seen is the rise of people really actually not all that different from you guys, you know, who go beyond their day jobs to try to sort of pull the sector in the direction of its mission by unconventional means, right? And, you know, you guys created the biotech Hangout in order to bring more people together and discuss key issues. You didn't have to do it. You know, you're helping to spark some discussions that probably make all of us better, right? And there are people who volunteer their time with Bio. There are people who volunteer their time with No Patient Left Behind, right? These are all examples of ways that people go above and beyond just their job. And so in the report that we put out, I reference an article that was written by biotech CEO Steve Potts, who actually went and testified in front of Congress. So speaking of going above and beyond your job, you know, most people have not, you know, been willing to go quite that far because it's tough, right? You know, they come after you. But he testified in front of Congress about, you know, the impact of price controls on innovation and the consequence to all of us. And it was a very impassioned testimony. But he wrote an article where he analogized developing drugs, you know, being a CEO of a company and helping develop drugs, kind of like biking up tough trails, right? And you're doing the work, you're huffing, puffing, you're sweating, you know, until you realize that, you know, somebody out there is not only biking those trails, but also carrying the tools with which to maintain those trails. Those trails don't just exist, you know, because they're meant to exist, right? The patent system is not some God-given system. Market-based pricing is not a given. In lots of countries, there are price controls. You know, it's not the market that sets the price, it's just the government decides, right? And so there's all these elements of policy that are decided by people. And therefore, you know, they can be just changed on a whim. You know, you call that stroke of the pen risk. And so, you know, those people who do that extra work of biking up and down the trails and maintaining them, you know, are really the ones that make it possible for everyone else to simply ride their bikes up and down the trails. All of a sudden, it makes drug development look downright easy. Compared to doing drug development and maintaining the framework that enables drug development to be done. And so I thought it was such a great analogy. I think that as more people wake up to the fact that when they ride those trails, they are essentially free riding off the work of others like themselves, fellow investors, fellow executives that are putting in the extra hours, you know, what does it say about a person if they say like, yeah, I'll just keep free riding? I think it's pretty unbecoming, right? You know, to be a free rider. So if you're an investor, you know, who considers themselves to be, you know, a key part of this ecosystem, then preserve it, protect it, figure out what you can do. Write an op-ed. At the very least, when the letter goes around, you know, for signatures, read the letter. And if you agree with it, sign it. We find that there are a lot of people who say like, oh, I don't like to get political. You know, in our report, we address that particular point. You know, I think everything is politics. Everything you care about requires getting out there and participating in the discourse. You don't have to literally lobby. You don't have to talk to senators, but we do need to educate the public. We got to engage with the public, address their outrage over out-of-pocket costs, right? And agree with them that those should be lowered. But you're not going to lower out-of-pocket costs through price controls. You got to lower out-of-pocket costs by reforming insurance. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the big excuses that we heard from a lot of investors that remained on the sidelines, and Steve Potts actually went through a bunch of letters and cross-referenced every, like the top 100 funds that have funded biotech with which of them show up as having people that sign those letters. Right. So I love the data driven approach and he did it.
Are those in the 43?
Yeah, I think that all 41 funds that we consider to be, you know, specialists are on that list. And not all of them, by the way, have been active. There's quite a number that are on the sidelines. And some of them, you know, I've reached out to directly. And I've said, hey, you know, it would be great to have you at least sign on, lend your name, you know, and I've been told by some like, we can't, I can't, I'd love to, but my partners won't allow me. And it's like this really insistent bystanding, right? And so then you can't help but ask why, And a common reason that you hear from some is, oh, our LPs, our limited partners, the investors in our fund, they want us to keep our heads down and just, you know, pick stocks or just fund companies, just do our jobs. And, you know, it's like, well, that's interesting because I have a lot of investors that I answer to, and I've clearly, you know, stuck my head out, and they don't tell me that I should, you know, stick to my job. They seem to recognize that this is part of the job. So we asked some capital allocators. We asked some of these individuals, including, you know, the chief investment officer of Harvard, for example, you know, can you give us your thoughts? You know, something I can include in this report on how you feel about whether managers, you know, should be commenting, you know, engaging with the public, you know, even speaking with members of Congress about how innovation works, how it's funded, and what the consequences of one policy or another might be. And they said, yeah, we'd love for them to get out there and educate, you know, like don't just sit there and, you know, invest while there's investing to be done. Protect the framework that enables us to invest and make new medicines. This isn't just about making money. We're all humans. We need these medicines. This is going to help our kids, our parents, ourselves, right? And so I don't know whether getting those three quotes that we include is going to be enough to dispel that one particular excuse that, oh, you know, I'd love to help, but, you know, my LPs don't want me to get political. But we pointed out that there's another way that, you know, executives can change and shape investor behavior. They can simply reward the behavior they'd like to see, right? So for example, I know that executives don't like it when investors flip in and out of stocks, right? That's not considered to be a sign of a long-term, you know, holder. Okay, so, you know, generally speculators pay the price for trading in and out of stocks. They're not the ones who get selected for financings. Well, executives are also able to take a look at who seems to be helping to maintain the trails that they themselves need to, you know, climb, right? And maybe those might be the investors that you would like to include in your financings when, let's say, all else is equal. I'm not suggesting you have to take a lower term sheet, you know, but if you can fill out your whole round, you know, with people that are actively working to preserve the innovation framework, then maybe do that and make it clear that that's what you, you know, did as an executive. Because I can tell you when investors start to pay the price for bystanding, they will change. And their own LPs are going to say, wait, are you missing out on deals, you know, because you're bystanding? In that case, let me encourage you. Please get.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I think we lost Peter for a second. Luba, did you want to say something?
Yeah, just to add a few notes. I think that I completely agree with Peter and others as well on this point. I think sometimes we are so overeducated and overthink in this industry, in the biotech industry, and don't realize that biotech, as many have mentioned today, is very complicated. And how the making of drugs is very hard. It's not just very hard, but it's actually a complicated process. And even for the various different modality, it's a completely, entirely different process, as we all know. Now, the and I'm not even talking about the public and understanding of the public, but when you think about policymakers and healthcare economists that are influencing policymakers, they have a hard time understanding how drugs are even made. So forget about innovation and what does that mean and what are some of the policy recommendations, how that affects innovation. We have done such a bad job because we stand on the sidelines educating policymakers on how drugs are made. I'll give you a very quick example. I had a top healthcare economist policymaker coming through our company through the lab after in a painstaking way explaining exactly what we do. Now we're a preclinical company, what we do, how we do it, and what pharma does. And again, they think of pharma as manufacturers and they think of all biotech as manufacturers. This individual has turned to me and after this long tour and explanation of what we do, asked me, okay, this is all great. Where do you manufacture the drugs? And I was shocked because clearly this individual has missed the entire point of what biotechs and many, many biotechs, especially in the preclinical space, what it is they do and how innovation in the biotech space works. So I do think that this is not just to the advantage of innovation and driving it forward, but I do think many LPs are also, and I see this, are changing their viewpoint and recognizing that more education is better, and standing on the sidelines is going to not just confuse people, but uneducate them to a point that they really don't quite understand, and they shouldn't. This is not their area of expertise, but we could do a much better job by stepping in and being more vocal, and not judging, but more vocal in education of
For sure. And so we have about 5 minutes left. So I'm going to ask everybody to go around and just we can talk a little bit about what we're looking forward to in 2024 and JP Morgan. But just to sum up, you know, definitely go take a look at the RA capital analysis that they just put out. We've shared it on Biotech Hangout. You know, get involved with bio, get involved with No Patients Left Behind. And think about ways that, you know, you can make a difference in the ecosystem. So going to JP Morgan, I will just say that we're having a party, Biotech Hangout Party, and a lot of the hosts will be there and a lot of folks that you might recognize from Bio Twitter. We've shared the information. We have, I think, last year we had close to 1,000 RSVPs. I think we're getting up there now. So we have sponsors, including J&J and a number of others, which I'm sorry that I don't remember everybody right now, but I'll remember before the end of the show, and free drinks. So that'll be on Tuesday night. And I'm looking forward to getting out there. I hope my flight doesn't get delayed. It's on Sunday night and there's a storm. So I will ask everybody to go around and maybe start with Josh and just talk about either JP Morgan or 2024, what you're looking forward to. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I still see tremendous opportunity out there for investors. There's a great lineup of high quality private companies that are gearing up to IPO. I think the IPO window is going to start to open substantially more in 24 than it was in 23. You know, as always, it's a stock picker's sector. Still a lot of companies out there that are very speculative, fairly valued or potentially overvalued, but that's kind of the fun of the sector, is finding those terrific opportunities. And there's nothing like a dislocated sector to create all sorts of really interesting, compelling names to own throughout the market cap spectrum. So I was very bullish, over the course of the fourth quarter. Probably for the industry more broadly, I think now it's starting to become a little bit more selective bullishness.
Thanks, Josh. Paul?
Yeah, I agree with Josh totally, right? I mean, I think we are entering more of a risk-on market in biotech, only we're entering it, you know, at a level for the XBI that is pretty healthy and still heavily discounted to some of the kind of prior highs over the past 7 or 8 years. So it feels like the setup into this area is good. I mean, you're seeing stocks really work on strong clinical data, right? I mean, one of the kind of challenges I think people were having in this peak during the third quarter was, do I own something into this catalyst if I'm not going to get paid to take on the risk? I mean, I'm not getting that question at all. And then, you know, I think the other question was, is the M&A wave going to happen? And we'll see if it continues. But, you know, I think from a perception perspective, we're in a good place. I agree with Josh on, you know, the window for potentially earlier stage companies. You know, we still have, you know, some big catalysts in the sector that are going to kind of drive, you know, sentiment. I mean, I think some of the things next week at JP Morgan that I'm paying the most attention to, you know, on the larger cap side, or does Vertex, you know, have any more data for their pain program? You know, that's a program that's, I think, valued at tens of billions of dollars, right? And it's one that could be paradigm shifting, but pain trials are hard. You know, for BioMarin, I think there's a lot of interest in the public appearance for the new CEO and the strategic direction of that company. You know, JP Morgan, right? I mean, Tim was kind of saying this, right? Like, who knows how many deals are going to be on Monday? It feels like there's too much pressure a lot on JP Morgan, but I feel pretty good going into this year.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Tim?
I think Peter has touched on, you know, one thing that's very critical for our sector, which is the politics, the government, the pricing, The other two big trends that are very much on my mind, one is this shift of our industry towards bigger drugs for bigger diseases. And I see that shift continuing this year. I think it's kind of inevitable given what's happening on the payer side in general. The second thing that is very much on my mind is what's happening in the obesity market. I read reports from virtually every brokerage house, investment bank. I'm sure, Peter, you must be like inundated with these things. And, you know, universally, people are talking about the importance of the obesity market. What is so striking to me is today it's largely a private pay market, and it could be a $100 billion private pay market. That's profoundly empowering for our industry because, in a sense, the government has nothing to do with that market. And I must say that I was electrified when I saw the press release from Eli Lilly yesterday on Lilly Direct that will allow a pharma company for the first time to go and essentially sell an obesity drug straight to a customer. Completely game changing in terms of how our industry is structured, very threatening to a number of players, and I think very healthy for a sector.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting as well. Luba. And then Peter.
Yeah. Quickly, agree with Paul and Tim. Tim couldn't agree with you more. I think the recent Lilly news from yesterday is very empowering. And then seeing also a trend, as we've seen and will continue, of companies coming out of companies that shouldn't have really been there, either are no longer there or they're being cut down substantially. And that's what we needed in the market, and also more focus on larger diseases, cardiometabolic space, neurospace, autoimmune disease space, and larger oncology indications as well, especially as in the need to go beyond the preclinical and focus on, I would say, phase two ready and phase three ready assets. So we'll continue that shift. I do think, and we all know that pharma M&A is usually pharma likes to repeat what other pharma companies are doing. So I don't see M&A slowing down in 2024. If anything, I think it will continue.
Thanks, Luva. Peter?
Yeah, I think that the M&A trend that we've seen this past year is going to continue. And as it continues, it's going to further distill the sector down to a size that either is going to be a lot smaller than what we've seen before, or is going to attract in new companies. And, you know, I think it's definitely going to attract a lot more companies to switch over from the private to the public side, frankly, because all they're doing is just switching where they are in the portfolios of a lot of these specialists, right? So we're going to find that the cash that previously we would have preferred to put into publics, as these companies are getting acquired, we now, you know, are going to be redirecting that cash to our best private companies. And it's just easier for us, given our fund structures, oftentimes to do that via an IPO, right? And so these aren't exits for us. You know, this is just a transition. So you are going to see, I believe, you know, plenty more crossover events. And then I'll give you one more prediction that's, you know, totally different from what we've discussed. I think you're going to see a lot more companies interested in something called generalized cost effectiveness analysis, GCEA. And this is kind of like doing an NPV on the value of a medicine to society, right? And to figure out what's it really worth. Now, there are groups out there that do that in a very narrow way. They're called like ICER and NICE, and they willfully ignore a whole bunch of values of a medicine to say how little it's worth to society. And so they claim drugs are overpriced. But I think companies and maybe even some sell side analysts are going to start offering GCEAs up as evidence of the fact that their drugs are worth a lot more than the kinds of prices that you see out there. Like Trikafta is in fact cost saving to society. Vertex could have charged a lot more and it still would have been worth it at a societal level. But you know, market forces, competition, everything allows society to get a bargain. So I think that you're gonna see companies avail themselves of this new tool, you know, to make a case to society that what we're working on is really worth it, right? 2024, I think, will be the year where we'll see a lot more of that, and then it'll become the norm.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, it's great to work in an industry where we are having a positive impact on society, and we shouldn't forget about that. So the we'll look forward to seeing you all next week at the Tweetup, which is going to happen at, it's a biotech hangout Tweetup on Tuesday, January 9th from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time at Persona. And I'd like to thank our sponsors, Johnson & Johnson, Bank of California, MISPRO, FTI Consulting, Point Cross Life Sciences, and PureTech. I don't know how I forgot that one. Thank you, everyone, for a great discussion. I look forward to seeing you next week, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.